Hi, I'm Xyveria Simmons. I am the host of the Reading the Museum podcast series. Today's episode is episode 2, which focuses on grievances inside of our website and part of the cohort's work. The grievances podcast sets the scene of what was happening in 2020, the emotion, the agency, the personal storytelling of artists, arts workers, museum staff, and also directors. So many of the grievances have to do with the fulcrum of power and wealth, and the grievances really highlight the disparities between the top of the power and wealth structure and the staffs, artists, and arts workers who work within institutions as well as the communities. I thought I would read something that one of our cohort members, George Shear, said prior to the recording of this podcast episode, which features Frederick Jenga of the Museum of Contemporary Art Santa Barbara and Lori Fogarty of the Oakland Museum of California. So George couldn't be with us for this particular podcast on grievances, but he had a really interesting thing to say that I thought would really help to set the tone and open up this episode. So he said, "For me, what is worth noting is that the reason we place grievances so predominantly and at the front of our work, it is a way to disarm the grievances and bracket them from the work institutions must do. These grievances are not new, and they are in every institution and every locale. They are in some ways the same typography of categories and are all derived from the same issues of whiteness, patriarchy, wealth, and power. They do emerge differently in each institution and from each community. How institutions do the work of addressing core systemic issues to get a better understanding of their accountability is how they will gain the strength to respond to and be accountable to the specific grievances in their community." And I just want to say that this episode is personal, and we hope that you take the episode, take the learnings, and move with grace and ease as you hear the grievances and as they land in your body, and as you work to undo a lot of the systemic issues within your institution. So please enjoy this podcast episode of Grievances from Reading the Museum. Thank you. I want to welcome you to episode 2 of the Reading the Museum podcast, which is Grievances. We will be joined by Lori Fogarty, Frederick Jenga, and myself. This podcast series is a conversation with museum and institutional directors, artists and arts workers, chronicling the cohort of Reading the Museum's work and the story of what we did and how we engaged, changed, and transformed. If we can do it, you can do it. Understanding, knowing, listening, and acting upon the grievances brought from the base of the museum to the larger museum system, as well as the grievances external and internal to the museum, is critical to accountability and the RTM method. I'll read from the purpose statement of the grievances issue, which is located on the Reading the Museum website, and hopefully will frame the conversation as well as frame the grievances. We're going to do a couple of framing exercises in the beginning of this podcast so that we level set, because we understand that grievances kind of bring up a lot of heightened emotions. So from the purpose statement of the grievances issue, training and listening sessions without sustained action are performative at best and extractive at worst. Land acknowledgments without reparative plans tied to local indigenous protocols are placeholders for sustained engagement and tangible shifts for those same local indigenous and Black communities. Museum surveys, token hires, white papers, artist talks, and even at times exhibitions, acquisitions, and other such symbolic gestures are additional placeholders for tangible and fundamental change. Structural change requires a long-term commitment to equitable, material, financial, and concrete transformation. Naming the problem is critical. Foregrounding this non-exhaustive list of grievances prioritizes the perspectives of individuals, activists, collectives, and communities who have been calling for change since the inception of the museum. We gathered these accounts primarily through one-on-one conversations with artists, museum leadership, arts workers, and members of their communities, as well as through social media platforms and from our research into the multitude of objections found in the sector. Further, it provides context and demonstrates the profound need for new ideas and solutions. So I want to welcome my guests to the podcast, my other cohort members, Lori and Freddie. Hi, guys.
Hello there.
Hi, how's it going?
It's good. So I wonder if we could start. We received a message from one of our cohort members, George Shear, who couldn't be here, but he has some thoughts that he wanted to share to kind of also level set and set the stage. And I thought Frederick would read those, read that message.
Yeah, I'd be happy to, Xiveria. Thank you. For me, and this is from George Shear, one of our cohort members, for me, what is worth noting is that the reason we place grievances so predominantly and at the front is a way to disarm them or bracket them from the work institutions must do. These grievances are not new, and they are in every institution and every locale. They are in some ways the same typography of categories and are all derived from the same issues of whiteness, patriarchy, wealth, and power. They do emerge differently in each institution and from each community. How institutions do the work of addressing core systemic issues to get a better understanding of their accountability is how they will gain the strength to respond to and be accountable to the specific grievances in their community.
Amazing. Amazing. How does that sit with you, Lori, as we move into?
Yeah, it's very powerful. I mean, I think that as folks in our community read the website and look at the grievances, you may have a reaction and you may feel it in your body, whether you're an artist or arts worker, feeling the call to action or the anger or the resentment or the frustration that some of these grievances convey, or you're a museum director or museum leader and you feel it in the defensiveness, or you feel it, you know, wanting to take issue with it or say, not my institution. And so I just want to recognize that this is, it's challenging stuff, even the word grievances. And yet we, as George so eloquently stated, it is necessary to moving toward accountability and toward really listening to the base. So I think we'll encourage you again at the end of this podcast, take it in at the beginning as you dive into this material, go through some of the other methodology and maybe come back to it. But some of this stuff is not for the faint of heart, that's for sure.
All right. So I'm just going to quickly set the scenes just so we remember why Reading the Museum and why we've come together. We came together in the midst of the global pandemic. The Reading the Museum cohort was formed as a result of the state-sanctioned murder of Black men and women, which in the art world culminated in a watershed moment, particularly for institutions who were already facing many backlashes from arts workers, front of house staff, unionizing arts workers, and also communities via on-site protests and via social media accounts that had already been prior to 2020, you know, speaking on the kind of structural damages and the community damages that were happening for institutions. I think this moment continues to present museums with a critical lens because as we know, most museums are currently constructed via their hierarchical framework. So that's kind of setting some of the tone. Museums have always been called out by their stakeholders and their communities in various ways, especially pertaining to the colonial structures that make up museums. And I think prior to 2020, we had groups like Decolonize This Place and Strike MoMA, who very much talked about the hierarchy, talked about the kind of toxic patriarchy, heteronormativity of museums, as well as the violence that museums have enacted to communities in many different levels, and also board members and some staffers. So this is the scene that Reading the Museum really was birthed within. And this is the scene that we're really still in today, actually. And so we thought it was really important to make sure we understood the grievances, not only internally inside of the institution via the staff, artists, arts workers, even executive directors, and maybe some board members, but also externally and how people were asking for systemic change.
Yeah, I mean, I would jump in here and say that, you know, this was also a time when, you know, I think artists and arts workers had sort of an increased visibility through social media platforms and accounts like Change the Museum and others that allowed some anonymity, but also were very pointed in their experiences. I think, you know, to what Lori said earlier about, you know, the feelings, whether, you know, depending on which perspective you're coming from, they were very emotional. I know that I even submitted one very early on.
I didn't know that, from
a traumatic experience I had leaving MCA as a staff member. Some of the language the board used to me was really disturbing. And anyways, I feel like there was an agency, and I think there still is. I just feel like maybe less people are paying attention. And I think the point, just to say again, like, the grievances have not changed and they're not new, but who's listening?
Right. I mean, I think about the time when this became so forefronted, and it was such a unique context, because I can speak, you know, to my experience at our institution. I mean, obviously it was during COVID. So people were at home and distanced. And so there was that kind of, you know, sort of alienation and isolation that people were feeling, but also empowerment. And I can say, for me, you know, the first moment that I really loudly and clearly heard the staff grievances at the Oakland Museum of California was in a staff meeting that was just days from the murder of George Floyd. And it was all on Zoom. And what I heard and how I was approached and how our staff felt empowered would probably never have happened live in person in a staff meeting. People would not have felt comfortable or empowered to say what they said. So there was something about the Zoom moment as well as the social media moment. People were also, you know, most museums were closed at that moment. And so there was time. I mean, there was time for people to gather, to galvanize, to organize. And it was also, you know, museum directors had to listen. So museum directors were in a position of having to be confronted with these changes. And I would say the other moment, because again, these weren't new demands, they weren't new grievances. In fact, you know, some of the unionizing efforts at museums predated this moment. But it was also really focused on especially frontline staff, because as museums started to open, who was put in most danger, who was having to confront the health issues, who was having to actually possibly encounter angry visitors or having really difficult public exchanges was frontline staff. So it was certainly a reckoning for me in my position, both directly with my own staff, and then I would say, we were called out and changed the museum a couple of times. And so experiencing that. So we can talk more about sort of the reaction of that. But I do, without taking us all back to that very difficult time, I think the conditions and the context aligned that there was a moment, as you said, it was so forefronted. And as you said, Freddie, the grievances are the same. The need is just as urgent, if not more so. But some of the conditions have made it even harder for that, for these grievances to be front of mind.
Something that I will, you know, I want to add to what you're saying, Lori, is that for me, as a person who descends from chattel slavery, who is from New York, who is a Black woman, who's an artist, arts worker, for me, a lot of these grievances, there's layers of the grievances. There's some grievances that are a part of the structures of the museum. And then there are some grievances that are a part of being an artist and the labor that is needed and the resources that aren't provided. And then there are other resources. You keep compiling resources, piling them on. There are grievances around the hierarchy, the colonial structure, also the racial dynamics inside of institutions and the labor dynamics and how those play out. So for me as an artist, it was critical to A, voice the grievances that I had with institutions, especially around this time, but also to organize with other artists. And I'm so thankful to people like William Paujita, who brought me in to really organize deeply with artists and arts workers to understand, like, artists have to support each other. The same can be said with what we're doing with Reading the Museum and what the methodology is, which is to lean on each other so that the grievances don't eat you up. Because I think a lot of the times when we have grievances around labor, around resources, around wealth, around hierarchies inside of institutions where we labor, they can sometimes eat you up. Because most of these grievances at the end of the day have roots and stem from systemic issues rooted within the construction of the country and our economic systems and how they have worked to legally or matter-of-factly cause oppression and wealth calcification due to indigenous land theft and enslavement and the construction of whiteness for the sake of building the capitalist empire that we live within, which is the United States. So I just wanted to kind of add that in, because these grievances have continued to multiply even as people want to try to push them aside.
I think articulating the perspective of artists there, this is what has been so powerful too in Reading the Museum, is bringing together the sort of institutional organizational perspective, but also the artist perspective, because I can say what I think many art museums have leaned on historically is, we're not going to take a position. It's the artists that are taking the position, and it's the artist's voice, and they can kind of, you know, stand behind their sort of quote-unquote neutrality, but then present the work of artists who are expressing these grievances. And that's where there's been such a disconnect, is that you expressed and have expressed throughout the Reading the Museum, is it's not right for museums to go ahead and let the artists take the risk and the artists do the labor and then, you know, exempt the institutions from the calls for change.
The institution is made up of individuals, right? So there's a, you know, I want to make it clear, because when you think about grievances and you think about structures, there is a board of directors who oftentimes is invisible to people, who people don't get to engage with regularly. Then there's the executive director and the executive team. Then there's the curators and that staff, you know, who are putting on the exhibitions, installers. Then you have, you know, other arts workers, front of house. Then you have obviously janitorial and, you know, taking care of the institution. And then you have these artists who we are like visitors most of the time, although many of the people inside of that structure are also artists, right? So they're holding, people are wearing many hats. And even inside of that, you still have this like hierarchical structure that doesn't allow for grievance to really move and be digested and worked through and worked with.
Although these are not new and although they are still relevant, I think what's been interesting about this work with Reading the Museum is seeing them all visually pulled together and archived, right? And I know that this will be also somewhat ongoing, but, you know, for me, I think it was very remarkable to experience the way the issue is on our website as really this document, because, you know, although there are various manifestos and things like that around, it was a really interesting kind of culmination of all this work. And so if at the very least, if we've been able to be a repository for these grievances, I think that already is like a big win to in many ways cement them and take them forward and keep them alive. I think one of the things that I was to do today was to call out the core principles of Reading the Museum, the first being a commitment to personal work and discomfort. We've all spoken about this already, even with just this theme, right? Centering the base and its leaders. I know we've said this before too, but kind of looking at, you know, who's been most harmed, right, as well as being worthy of the most attention. And three, doing your own labor, ongoing and imperfect. I think we spoke about this as well, right? We're all doing this work. We're all at different journeys, right? We're not all the same people. We are from very different backgrounds and places of power and not power and powerful and powerless. And I think that's, again, something that makes this cohort really interesting and dynamic is that it is such a diverse spread, and how we enforce that diversity within the types of presentations like this podcast. And then for the accountability, the group here, we have an accountability statement. But again, this is something that I've personally been very thoughtful about, especially around the work that we're doing at the museum in Santa Barbara, but also my own work within how I bring people into the Reading the Museum conversation. I think somebody in particular would be Dahlia Garcia. We invited her to be an accountability partner for our, first conversation, semi-public conversations around this work in New York. And I think in many ways, she remains somebody that I'm accountable to in the work that we're doing at the museum and the way that we've supported and uplifted her, desires and call. And, some of those first grievances for her being an Indigenous, immigrant was really around wanting to be contemporary, wanting permission. I think that's what, in one of our conversations, she actually asked, she's like, I want permission to be contemporary, to be seen as somebody who's, has something to contribute. And I think that is something that continues to resonate with me. This also dovetails a lot with what Xavier's touched on earlier around communication, amongst ourselves and amongst those that we begin to engage with once we sort of shared this accountability statement of ours, right? Like, there's a certain amount of inherent defensiveness that could arise with this type of work, but that we're at the point where hopefully we can model to other institutions and other groups coming together the importance of communication and having these agreements, right? We had community agreements, which I'm sure we'll address in a different podcast, but I think that's been critical to doing the work, is to have an understanding that we have some agreements. Well, so this is where the lexicon comes in, right? Not to spoil everything, but like, it's all connected, right? If we don't have those things and we don't work on these things simultaneously, then it's going to be hard to listen to grievances and not be defensive. It's going to be hard to respond to grievances without offending or bending yourself in an uncomfortable position even, right? So yeah, I think that's critical, the communication and again, holding space for each other. And I think that's critical work that we're modeling every time we engage with new communities. And it's really critical to this accountability conversation.
And one thing I will say is that for Mickey and I, as we built the cohort, and so it's now the cohort also together, is that we realized that perhaps RTM, Reading the Museum, could bridge the divide between what we felt were very simple demands, like pay equity, transparency policies, community engagement at the board level, greater representation of communities, local Indigenous practices honored. These are not new. These were nothing like surprising, new, shocking. And these are things that have been brought to many museums' doors before COVID, but definitely after COVID and into now and on social media. So, and that's really how Reading the Museum takes its best shape, is that we are I say this a lot throughout this podcast series, we are a metabolizing digestive body who I, as an artist, can talk to clearly to Lori or Freddie, who are not artists in the same way. They are artists in different ways, but they're, one is a museum director, one is a board chair / amazing human being / hospitality director, and overall amazing human being that goes beyond words, and Freddie. But I, if there is a grievance that I might have with another institution, I can metabolize and digest and figure out how to move with this group of people. That only comes from trust built going through the methodology, the Reading the Museum methodology, going through and having trust that Lori has and is continuing to do her whiteness work, that Frederick is doing his patriarchy work alongside all of the other fun times we have together. And these are the recommendations that we have for institutions so that when the grievances do arrive, because they will, And the same way that there will be internal and external forces, whether it be local events or internal events or worldwide events, when the grievances do come, that there's already a metabolizing body inside of the institution, from the board to the maintenance staff, who have already built fortitude together to be able to do the necessary work and change and conversations, and they can bring this to their community. But we're going to take you back just a little bit again, so that Lori can kind of talk a little bit about, you know, some of the challenges, and we're going to get into some of the grievances that we have inside of our website, and we'll also be pretty personal. So I just want to prepare folks for that as well, because the transparency of us being personal helps to illustrate the vulnerability that we're asking for as part of the methodology, the personal vulnerability, the personal work, so that there can be a shift in the system.
There's so much that you both shared there that I'm still processing, but a couple things I want to note, which is, as we assembled the grievances, there are grievances represented there from that would represent the perspective of museum directors. And I want to note that some of these grievances that Xaveria just listed around pay equity and transparency and compensation for labor and adoption of Indigenous protocols, many museum directors would say those are really, really hard to achieve, and that they are in the position often of being in that the very fulcrum of the tension between boards and staff. And that's what I hear from many of my colleagues. And so in those moments where the Change the Museum posts were happening, and, you know, I picture sort of, you know, the phone lines of museum directors lighting up all across the country. You were wondering who was going to get called out next and how they were going to respond, and hearing about, you know, position changes or departures or major upheavals at other institutions. And you were walking around thinking, okay, when am I going to be next, or who's going to be next? And so it was very challenging, and it was met with a lot of defensiveness. And I will just say that this is where I think that the whiteness work and or the whiteness and patriarchy work is so critical. And part of the way that I worked through this and have worked through this through running the museum is we did have a whiteness group. We have a whiteness group here at the Oakland Museum. They are facilitated groups. And it took a lot of work to move beyond the defensiveness, especially if, you know, there are a lot of white women in museum director roles. And we already think of ourselves like, we're the good people, we've done the good work. And look at me even being in this position as a woman, I've had to work for everything I've gotten. I've had to fight hard. So to be put in that position of actually having to go back and say, look at all of the privilege that I've had that was invisible to me until I really explored it. And RTM called on us, our cohort members called on the members of the cohort that were white to go through that. And it is only through that work, that personal work, and the base building and accountability work, where I've come to understand grievances as actually brave offerings. In some cases, it's super hard for staff to convey some of the, I mean, they're taking a big risk too in stating some of these demands. And artists, you know, Xaveria has, you know, had to be incredibly courageous to take the position. Sorry to talk about you in third person. I'm looking at you now, that you've taken the position that you've had to take with boards and collectors and museum directors. And so I think moving from a place of seeing these as offerings that can help organizations change, and that these are perspectives coming typically from the base, and shifting the understanding of who we're most accountable toward, has been what has enabled me to consider these grievances as opportunities. And not to sugarcoat it, because it's never easy. And, you know, there have definitely been grievances that I have not been able to figure out how to appropriately respond to yet. But I'm in a much better position to understand that what we're being asked to do is to do less harm.
Exactly. And if I can just speak for some of our other cohort members who aren't here, there's a really great section in the whiteness part of the website and the issue where Olga Viso goes through her process of being a museum director and having the Indigenous community near her museum call her out courageously, and her having to depart that institution, and how she had to reckon, deal with both the personal work of understanding the grievances that were placed at her doorstep and with the institution, and also the effects of being between community and authority or board leadership. So she chronicles those things, and I think it's really a brilliant piece of writing. And I think that for me as an artist and arts worker, I am gonna align. I love my executive directors. I've got friends who are philanthropists and board chairs and board members, and I've sat on many boards, but I am an artist. I'm a laborer. I work with heavy things. I work with my body and my spirit and my soul, but it's a physical thing. So when I hear an artist, an arts worker, or a community member, or a Black person who descends from slavery, or an Indigenous person whose land we sit upon, when I hear them expressing a grievance, for the most part, for most of the part, my eyes and ears are open. And I organize with Black, Brown, White, other artists to, you know, we have a kind of like a non-traditional artist union where we support each other through many different things that go on inside of institutions, from being front of house staff to being, you know, front of house staff that is being confronted by, you know, people coming into the institution to cause harm, or being underpaid and like not having enough to fall back on to advocate for ourselves. I mean, there's from that to like artist fees, contracts. I mean, the grievances go on and on top of the white supremacy and patriarchy that is the overarching theme of institutions anyway. So I thought we would, you know, read some of the grievances that we collected from our community of practice, our base, from ourselves, from the artists and arts workers we know and work with, and also maybe some grievances that our own institutions, if we lead them, have called us out on. And some of these grievances, a lot of them are particular to institutions, but a lot of them are systemic. So we thought we would read some of them for the listening community. And Freddie's also going to kind of describe how we came up with the term grievances.
The word itself is used quite commonly in the sector. And I think that part of what we're trying to do and we model as a methodology is to come up with shared understanding of what words mean. And so I think for us, the term has a lot of power to point out that there's, in many cases, severe harm that happens when these things, like these are serious items. And I will just say, looking at the issue on our website, we have 101 pages of grievances. I mean, there is, I guess, a grievance per page, but maybe one of you also want to kind of contribute to the definition.
I mean, I would just say I've commonly heard it as a phrase. It's not just complaints. It's issues in a workplace. It's a terminology specifically used, you know, to address grievances when unions go into mediation or arbitration with employers. So I think that there's a seriousness. I appreciate that you said that, Freddie. There's a gravity to it. But it's also, you know, there's a sense of kind of legitimacy to it. Like there's evidence that's part of it as well.
I love that you brought up the unionizing, because I think it's also a grievance has been documented. Like there's a documentation of it. It's not just right. The complaint, right? It's not like right. I'm hungry and I'm not getting enough free food. You know, I don't know. You know, it's like, it's actually there's, because they may be systemic, right? These are grievances. These are issues that have been documented more than once, right? So yes. we can define them. We can prove them. We're not making stuff up here.
And it's structural, not personal.
Yes.
As well, you know, and I think that's part of the understanding to come to, is that this is not about blame and shame. We're not trying to, you know, create a list of things that are just meant to make people feel upset or bitter or defensive. These are the structural issues that are where change is called for.
Yeah, Lori, I think we should
I'm ready.
Read some of the Greek. You ready? Everybody's ready.
I'm not starting. No way.
You're not starting. No, I'll start because for me, the grievances were critical. I'm going to use a phrase that Mickey Garcia, the co-lead of Reading the Museum, says, you got to name it to tame it. She says this all the time. And I think it's really, it's critical. It's like, we got to know what's going on in our environment around us, institutions, and so that we can lay it bare and deal with it and not just hide behind executive suites and like board meetings or executive meetings. So I'll start with some of the grievances that really resonate with me and my own practice and the community of practice that I organize with and the artists and arts workers who I care for tremendously and who have told me these things time and time again. So one grievance that I find very close to heart, museums often suppress dissenting voices amongst their staff and visiting artists. Black and other POC men and women who disagree with the status quo are labeled as angry, difficult, or crazy. A patriarchal structure is having the majority of the clerical and administrative work performed by female presenting members of the institution. Continuous complaints from staff and arts workers are rarely addressed with any progress made. This can happen over years with staff and artists transitioning out of harmful institutions, environments, and with no mechanisms of accountability in sight. The museum does not support any racist work with time and financial resources. And some artists without these resources go from residency to residency, adjunct teaching and living grant to grant in order to advance their professional practice. The reality is many artists are barely able to put a housing roof over their heads. And another one is museums use multicultural exhibitions and temporary staff positions to avoid doing system-wide institutional change.
Thank you, Siberia. I feel like the ones that really resonate with me are always the ones that I have personal experience with, as I'm maybe with you as well. I mean, I think those seem like ones that could apply. You know, I think the one, it's a short and sweet one, but I love it. Boards lack overall accountability. Yeah. And I have seen time and time again that how decisions made on the board level have repercussions that harm, hurt, disrupt, and not even just the individuals, but the institution itself. And so, you know, where do you go from there? There's 0.0 accountability. So that's something that really resonates with me. I think the museums are not paying a living or livable wage for many staff members. I'd probably say most staff members. You know, I think there's a generally assumed reality within our sector that, you know, you have to kind of be wealthy to be able to do the internships and do all these things to be able to get to the positions that are paid. So, you know, that may mean you're not as reliant on it, right? And so there's no kind of normalcy around pay in our institutions, right? Like, I think there are great advocates for wage transparency and things like that and provide, you know, guidelines. But I know even in a recent case, you know, with our institution in Santa Barbara, we thought we were doing really great pay, right? Compared to, you know, and, you know, just a great, that's a great number, right? But then we go to a town hall meeting and we find out that low income, as it's described in our community, is probably about 20,000 more than what we're paying, what we thought was high, right? So that sends us back to like, well, we need to do some more work here. So I think these things I'm seeing not only how they are common or widespread. I think this is through the Reading the Museum lens, right? We're already thinking about how do we respond, right? Like it's not about like, oh, that's good to know, but no, we actually have to put all these things in place. I think one that also resonates a lot with me is the business model of the museum is overly reliant on private wealth. And I know, you know, we've had conversations, Siberia, about the really looking at the foundation of the museum as being this wealth management tool. You know, it's never been about anybody but the wealthy as a concept from the get-go, whether it's the resources that are, you know, poured into a support or accumulated objet that, you know, end up in these institutions. So I think those are, I guess one more, because as a brown person, I feel like I should say this because I think it, I shouldn't have a black person say this, but the angry black person is a common trope that surfaces when black people demand recognition and systemic change from institutions that often ask them to come into the museum to engage in the first place. And I think this is also, I've seen this play out. I've also seen the other side of this, of the anytime a black person and also a black woman speaking to change or speaking from a position of power immediately gets labeled as an attack, right? Mm-hmm. Like there's this default and I think this is related to the angry, and you know, is something that is more common than I think people acknowledge, and is really a true grievance. So an example is Chaitria Labourvier, who many know, you know, in 2019 became the first person of Cuban descent to curate an exhibition in the Guggenheim's 80-year history, as well as the first Black author of a Guggenheim catalog for the Basquiat exhibition. She took her grievances public, you know, against the racist treatment by the Guggenheim leadership and curatorial staff, and there were repercussions. And yet, you know, I think that's an example of, again, the how that angry black trope is positioned. But at the same time, we need to be talking about the white people that made it happen too, right? I mean, or that contextualized it in that way, because I think what happens a lot, and we've, I think, also kind of checked ourselves with some of the work we've been doing around these tropes of race and roles within institutions. So often it's the person who has been attacked or harmed who ends up being the center of the story, right? When it's actually no one's talking about the attacker, the abuser, the person who harmed, who most often is the white person.
Right. But everyone talks about slavery, but no one talks about slavery is a, for lack of a better word, slavery is a metaphor for white violence. Slavery is a metaphor for land theft, indigenous massacres, you know, all of the things that were put upon people. So I just want to just add that in, like the grievance, oftentimes the person bringing the grievance is labeled crazy or unfit, but that's because we invisibilize the perpetrators, for lack of a better word, of the harm, which is, you know, in museums, oftentimes it's wealth and whiteness. But Lori, on that note,
oh, good segue. So a couple that I, you know, from kind of my perspective that resonated with me that I thought a lot about, one is there is a lack of intersectionality among white feminists who have positional power within museums. They continuously extract resources and knowledge that are foundational to Latina, Black, and Indigenous feminist thought and practice. That was worth a lot of thought. And then this is one that I think is a grievance of museum directors. So I just wanted to highlight an example there. Museum directors serve at the pleasure of the board of trustees and are accountable to this governing body. Many structural inequities inside of the institution root in attitudes held and historic policies established by museum boards. Staff frustrations and arts workers' anger can often be misdirected at directors rather than boards, which hold the ultimate power and policymaking authority. So kind of the perspective of the director. This one I thought is also, we haven't talked a lot about this, but I think it's very interesting. Museum boards use hiring recruiters as a way to maintain the status quo and keep the structures in place. And I just think kind of an unseen part of our industry is how much directorships, they are led by the boards, but the power of recruiters to keep the status quo in place through the hires of directors that boards are comfortable with is an interesting aspect to note.
That's part of phase two also. That's so in right. Phase two, we will be talking with wealth managers, philanthropists, and also, you know, recruiters as a way to, you know, make obviously more recommendations to the sector around how they can become readier than they are right now.
Well, yeah, because they all stand at the fulcrum of power and wealth. and those decisions, you know, those critical decisions.
So I think we're kind of ready to wrap up. I guess I would just offer a couple of reflections. One is I want to give people heart that these grievances, they're still grievances, of course, and many of the same ones, and they continue as we talked about at the very beginning, but that there is hope. I can say in our case, many of the grievances that came up during the summer of 2020, we've taken to heart institutionally and have made some shifts. Of course, it's not enough. And I will say that our staff is unionizing, has unionized this past spring. And so we will continue to, that will be another forum for hearing grievances and responding to grievances. So I do want to say that for me personally, the demands and the calls for change that I heard from my staff have made a big difference. And it's through the work of Reading the Museum and other work we do here that I've been able to, I think, hear them in a different way. And I just encourage again, especially if you're feeling this in your body and feeling, you know, having trouble breathing or feeling like you're getting very tense, complete the rest of the podcast, listen to the whiteness podcast, listen to the accountability podcast, and then maybe come back to this and see where it lands for you at that point. And thank you to my colleagues in the cohort who really called upon us to name it, to tame it.
I guess I've been thinking about this question of what's still around or what are still like real grievances. And I feel like they're all still very applicable in so many different ways. And I think different institutions are on different paths towards responding and being accountable to them. Some even have solutions for solving them. But again, a lot of them seem hard. But if we just question why we've been doing it the way we've been doing it for so long, we often find there was really kind of no reason, but it's just that that was the way it was done. And I think if that's your response to a grievance, then it's going to be pretty easy to start thinking about solutions for shifting, you know, how you offer transparency, how you share power, ideas around mutual aid are human, you know, centuries old traditions. And if we bring some of these into our own personal practices, we'll find, I think, a lot more solutions to these grievances. And so hopefully moving forward, we'll start seeing less of them.
And I will just conclude by saying thank you to Lori and Freddie for another amazing conversation. And with Reading the Museum, if you go through the methodology, if you go on our website, if grievances is the first place you've listened to on this podcast series for some reason because you were excited to hear the tea, if you go on to our website, and you start from the beginning where you look at the FAQs, which helps you shake the jitters out and get your questions answered. And then you go down the kind of like ladder of how we've laid it out. You will go through a process of not only understanding the grievances, but understanding the personal work that needs to be done, the interpersonal work and the collective work so that we can have healthy ecologies. And I want to give a shout out to unionizing artists and arts workers and people who have brought their grievances of all kinds to the front of the museum door. That is the only way, and that's artists and arts workers as well, who are inside putting artworks up to show global grievances, local grievances. But I really want to give a shout out to the artists and arts workers who I unionize with and who I support because they are the lifeblood, and also to the people, communities who bring the grievances. And I really hope in 20 years, people, museums will have gone through this methodology and there won't be as many grievances, or they will be minor grievances and they won't have their roots so deep into the structures and so a part of the systemic economic issues that we find ourselves living in within the United States. So I really, let's root out these structures and enjoy our lives. Anyway, thank you so much, Lori and Freddie, and thank you, Reading the Museum, once again. And I hope you guys enjoyed this episode.
Readying the Museum's podcast series is hosted by artist Xyveria Simmons and is created by the Readying the Museum cohort, which includes Director of Oakland Art Museum of California, Lori Fogarty, Director and Professor of Practice at ASU Art Museum, Mickey Garcia, board chair of MCA Santa Barbara, Frederick Janka, artist Chinupa Hamska-Luger, artist Cruz Ortiz, executive director of Elizabeth Foundation for the Arts, George Shear, chief curator and director of curatorial affairs of Phoenix Art Museum, Olga Viso, and artist Xiveria Simmons. Erin Donahue is our project manager and producer. Castos Productions is our production company, with a special thanks to Isel Brill and Craig Hewitt. Cruz Ortiz created the original cover art for our podcast. Funding for Readying the Museum comes from the Ford Foundation and Mellon Foundation, with additional support from ASU Art Museum and Arizona State University Herberger Institute for Design and the Arts. Because Readying the Museum is a collaboration between artists, arts workers, and museum directors, we would also like to thank the artists, studios, and their collaborators for their time and effort. You can sign up for our newsletter at readyingthemuseum.com. We're on Instagram at readyingthemuseuminfo. We're also on YouTube at Readying the Museum, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever else you listen to podcasts. Don't forget to check out the show notes for links to resources and more information on today's topics. Be sure to join us next week when we dive into new Readying the Museum episodes.